where the Israeli company Spacecom launched from Florida despite unfavorable weather. The Falcon 9 rocket lifted off at 7:23, a half an hour later than originally scheduled due to earlier rain and clouds in the area. It was launched from Cape Canaveral. Spacecom calls the Amos 17 the most advanced satellite designed for Africa. It also will cover parts of Europe and the Middle East. The Israeli satellite, which was built by Boeing, deployed into orbit about 31 minutes after liftoff. On Thursday, the neighboring Launch Complex 41 is set up for an early morning launch, carrying a U.S. Air Force communications satellite atop a United Launch Alliance Atlas V rocket.
For USA Radio News, I'm Tim Berg.
Welcome to Destination Hockey. We have another fantastic episode in store for you this week, but first let's highlight the live and local weather forecast. The weather is not looking great tonight. We have severe thunderstorms, 95% chance of rain throughout the night, patchy fog. It is not going to be pretty. Tomorrow, the fog continues, the thunderstorms go down to a 30% chance, but it will still be rain throughout the day. Friday, the sun comes out, it will be 85 degrees, and that sun will be continuing throughout the weekend. Saturday and Sunday are looking nice as well. So we have two rough days and then a nice weekend ahead, but don't worry about that yet. We have two exclusive interviews coming up on Destination Hockey. From the destination for all things hockey, we'll be right back.
Are you looking to get your message in front of a qualified audience through all the noise out there today? Consider taking an advertisement out on Hunterdon Chamber Radio, WHCR, DB, the voice of business. Contact the Chamber today at 908-782-7115 or give us an email at info@hunterdon-chamber.org.
Yesterday, our radio station had our summer meeting where we reviewed our goals and grew as a staff. It was productive and efficient. But imagine this situation. I walk in. My boss is sitting down at a table, graphs and charts plentiful, as he prepares to rip into my every move from the last 365 days. "You do not get enough listeners," he says. "You talk too fast," he says. "We do not need you," he says. And for those reasons, assuming in this hypothetical situation that I am paid for hosting this show, he wants to severely lower my salary. He insults me, degrades me, and most importantly, makes me feel unwanted, isolated, even afraid. Now, this is just a bizarre situation, but this happens in the National Hockey League. Arbitration is meant to settle contract disputes. Both the player and the team come into a hearing with financial numbers they want, and then this is where things get ugly. The aforementioned harsh debate ensues, damaging relationships long term. There's the case of Tommy Salo, a goaltender from the Islanders who played under the reign of terror that was Mike Milbury. After a brief run overseas, the young, delicate Swede came into the hearing nervous and scared. The prior year, he made $300,000 and was expecting a raise after a successful season, and to do that, he was going through arbitration. As detailed in Fish Sticks, a novel I highly recommend you all check out, Milbury's argument against Salo was so brutal and personal that Salo immediately broke into tears during the hearing. Salo wound up getting a nice raise of $450,000, but the memory literally scarred him. Whenever the topic was brought up in interviews throughout the rest of his career, Salo would tighten up and once again nearly break down to the verge of tears. Arbitration is brutal. It is unfair. And that is why players and teams should negotiate on their own terms. In most cases, the arbitrator's job isn't even that important. He or she splits the number right down the middle. For example, the Blues offer Joel Edmondson $2.3 million, Edmondson's camp counters with $4.2 million. Guess what the arbitrator gives him? $3.1 million right down the middle. That's how these cases go 99% of the time. So I propose teams take the extra call, be more open in their negotiations, and make their wants and desires more transparent. Then, instead of going into a contentious and tenacious hearing, they can meet down the middle and spare each other's feelings. I get it. Life is tough, but when you can avoid severing a relationship completely, just like poor Tommy Salo, there is a circumstance where you make the sacrifice and compromise. Welcome to Destination Hockey. My name is David Lazar. No arguments, no arbitration hearings today on the show, just two great interviews with two special guests. Joining us later in the broadcast is ex-Islander shootout specialist Rob Schremp. But first, we will hear from Winnipeg Jets reporter Murat Atiz. From the Destination for All Things Hockey, we will be right back with that exclusive interview.
You're listening to WHCR-DB, HunterdonChamberRadio.com. Brought to you by the Hunterdon County Chamber of Commerce, the voice of business.
¿Sabía que de cada cinco personas hay una que lucha con síntomas difíciles de salud mental? NAMI es una organización estatal sin fines de lucro. Somos empleados voluntarios. Somos la voz de la nación sobre las enfermedades mentales. NAMI te ofrece grupos de apoyo, educación e información. Nuestro programa educativo de Familia a Familia está dirigido por miembros de NAMI para familiares y amigos de personas que luchan con dificultad de salud mental. Llámanos al 888-803-3413. Recuerda, no estás solo. NAMI está contigo y no hay salud sin salud mental.
Did you know that 1 in 5 people are affected by mental illness? NAMI Hunterdon is the locally affiliate for NAMI, the National Alliance on Mental Illness. We are all volunteers, and all our programs are free of charge. We offer Family to Family, a 12-week course for families that have an adult member with a mental illness. Another popular program is In Our Own Voice, where individuals who are living with mental illness discuss their challenges and their progress in overcoming those challenges. Another course we offer is Basics, a 6-week course for families with a child or an adolescent who has experienced mental illness. We also have a monthly support group for families on the third Thursday of every month. Please call NAMI Hunterdon at 908-284-0500 for more information about any of our programs or to join. NAMI Hunterdon, the voice for mental health in Hunterdon County.
When it matters most, our award-winning team of emergency physicians and nurses provides sophisticated care 24 hours a day. Superior emergency care at a moment's notice. Hunterdon Healthcare, your full circle of care.
Welcome back to Destination Hockey. I would like to welcome a really unique special guest to the show that I have been looking forward to speaking with for a while now. Murat Atiz, thank you for joining me today. So, we discussed arbitration earlier in the show, and the Jets have a lot of open free agent cases. One of them that got settled, that was Neil Pionk, and you spoke to him last month. Just what type of player are the Jets getting?
They're getting a hungry one, that's to be sure. I think that the way Neil Pionk is at in his NHL career is that he's proven that he's an NHL defenseman, and then depending on what perspective that you have or what lens you want to look through, the amount of quality varies. So, he's got top-flight offensive skill. He skates well. But there are definitely concerns in terms of how well he protects his own end, how well he protects his own blue line. He spent a lot of time in his own end playing for New York last year. And the numbers would seem to indicate, in terms of possession and shot metrics and expected goals and all of that, a third-pairing defenseman at even strength with a bit of offense on the power play. That beautiful, beautiful end-to-end rush he scored against Montreal came at 4-on-4, and there's a little bit of extra space on the ice for him at that time, which really gave him the space to highlight his wheels. Other than that, I think Winnipeg's best situation for him would be on the third pairing, but I don't know that they have the depth to do that. So that's going to be a really interesting look for Winnipeg this year.
Where it gets interesting, however, is he was 34th in ice time in the entire NHL. He played a lot. Obviously, he can't get that time again with Dustin Byfuglien and Josh Morrissey there, but he's going to be getting a lot of playing time with a thin depth chart. Where do you see that role fitting in? Do you think it's that third pair that he probably should be in, or maybe even a second or first pair role?
I think that Winnipeg is banking on him to be a top four defenseman. So Neil Pionk's season in New York was a bit of a roller coaster. Started essentially on the top pair with Mark Stahl, and then there were some ups and downs. When I spoke to him for the Athletic, he commented on the roller coaster of confidence that he went on as different things came his way. I mean, at different times he was a healthy scratch. He was a gamer, and he appreciated the opportunity that he got, but he might have been a little bit overwhelmed there. So in Winnipeg, I think the Jets are banking on him to be capable of top 4 minutes, and I think perhaps an ideal pairing for him would be with Josh Morrissey, if that's the case, if Morrissey is in fact ready at the stage of his career to sort of carry somebody who's still developing. I think that's the idealistic look, that he's going to be a top 4 defenseman and the Jets are going to have success. And I think those minutes are going to stay high. Because, like you suggested, I don't know that third pairing has a lot of room for him. Winnipeg has other young defensemen like Sammy Niku or Tucker Poolman or other players that are still in the development path. And I think the Jets really need Pionk to take that step forward, not just be a top four defenseman in terms of minutes, but in terms of results and the way that he can carry play as well.
In your line prediction article for The Athletic, you predicted the third pair to be Dmitry Kulikov and Sammy Niku. That's not the greatest pairing on paper. Do you think that's suitable for a playoff contending team?
In short, no, not particularly, but a little bit longer. The difference in quality of minutes that a third pairing gets versus the top four is pretty big. As far as I've been able to look at, the first pair and the second pair get comparative minutes. Oftentimes, there's just no way to hide them from star players, but it's a little bit easier to do that with the third pairing. So if that was Winnipeg's only weakness on the back end, if they had two perfect pairings to kick things off, and then you had Kulikov and Niku, or Niku and Poolman, or maybe Beaulieu, or that there's combinations of players that could end up there, then I think Winnipeg would be just fine. The issue, I think, on Winnipeg's back end is that if you pair Morrissey with Pionk and you pair Dustin Byfuglien with Nathan Beaulieu, you've got a couple of question marks. Morrissey and Byfuglien can carry people for sure, but the other two players involved have never really truly excelled in that top four format. And so there's going to be holes however you draw it up, whether it's on that third pairing like you suggest or higher up.
Another area with holes is the offense, and they are currently under construction, per se, due to the uncertainty of Patrick Laine and Kyle Connor's futures. How are those negotiations coming along?
Well, I think that, like most of the league, there's a certain waiting pattern or holding pattern as people wait for the Mitch Marner situation to resolve and some of those other big-ticket restricted free agents that might be even a tier above Laine and Connor in terms of their impact on the ice and the contracts that they're going to get. That said, in having a few conversations around the league, the sense that I get is that there's not a lot of panic in Winnipeg about this right now. I think Kyle Connor is very happy with the situation he has in Winnipeg. He's getting big-ticket minutes at 5-on-5 on the first line with Scheifele and Wheeler, big-ticket power play minutes as well. And then he's been playing on the PK, too. So he's gotten every role, and his offense has been there back-to-back 30-goal seasons. I think that it's just a matter of getting the term and money sorted out for him. And in the case of Patrick Laine, he had one of the most interesting seasons that has ever happened. I mean, after that 5-goal game against St. Louis in November, and just he was absolutely on fire through that month, and was flirting with the NHL goal-scoring lead with Alex Ovechkin at times early in the season. And then, as we all know, he sort of fell apart offensively. Nothing went in for him, no matter how many of those beautiful one-timers he was set up for on the power play. Things just didn't work, and he had such a hot and cold year, and I think that the sense is that his indication or his preference right now would be a shorter term, let's see what happens, let's fill the net up some more, and then really, really cash in after maybe 2 years as an example.
Even though there's that feeling of confidence from the Jets front office, could a team with cap space and a need for scoring, like the Islanders per se, be a possibility for an offer sheet?
I think that's realistic. I mean, offer sheets are rare, and even to say that it's realistic, I don't mean that I necessarily think that it's going to happen. But the pieces are all in place. And to start with Winnipeg's cap situation, they're listed at $17.5 million in space right now, but that's a little bit misleading. You fill out their roster to even a 21-man roster, and that brings it down to about $15.5 million to sign Connor and Laine. That makes things a little bit tough for sure. And then in New York, with about $8.6 million in terms of cap space and a roster size that's already at 22, that's just enough space to make a meaningful offer sheet. And one of the reasons that I believe Winnipeg sort of has been standing pat throughout free agency and trying to maintain even the $15.5 million space that they have without, you know, shopping for a Jake Gardner or whatever, whoever else you might perceive is out there, is just in case an offer sheet exists. I don't think it's entirely absurd to think about it. And if anyone is at risk of that, in my opinion, it's Patrick Laine.
You see this offer sheet with these numbers coming in. Patrick Laine, Kyle Connor, I want to transition into what numbers you feel they're getting, because they're kind of in that weird threshold. Sebastian Aho got the offer sheet from the Montreal Canadiens. The NHL consensus in the media was that they did it wrong. But a player like Kyle Connor, he gets that $8 million range. What does a team like Winnipeg do? And Patrick Laine, do you see him coming in the $8, $9 million territory, even $10 million, or lower in the $5, $6, $7 on a bridge deal?
Well, I mean, that's the biggest question that in Winnipeg right now. And I think despite the bluster from the Jets front office publicly, as always, and we'll match any offer sheet, once you get into those sorts of territories, the numbers that you're talking about, it becomes a very difficult decision. I ran through at The Athletic a big projection where I looked at every player's second contract with comparable age and points production to Laine and Connor from the inception of the salary cap to now, and just found just the degree to which points per game and ice time to that point in their career predicted their salary. And the correlation was extremely high, and it implied Connor at more of a $7 million player and Laine a little bit closer to $8 million. If you're starting to offer Kyle Connor something approaching that $8.5 million threshold of offer sheet, I think Winnipeg's got to look long and hard at questioning whether there's value there, especially because he's already played best five-on-five situation, top power play as well. I know he's developing and he has more to give, absolutely, at this stage of his career, but his context on the ice has been as good as it gets. In Patrick Laine's situation, if you get up towards approaching that 10, it's another difficult situation as well, because he's not a possession-driving player, and he doesn't, with Brian Little, who he's played the most with at even strength, doesn't move the needle there. It's just his goal scoring that you're really, really betting on, which has, to this point, been superlative and even better than Kyle Connor's. So, what do I expect? I expect Kyle Connor, long-term, something close to $7 million, and I expect Patrick Laine to be a shorter-term deal, something more like 2 years. And maybe even with similar numbers to that, it would be an expensive bridge, and I think that we're at a point with just how many expensive restricted free agents there are, Marner, Aho especially, though Aho is a great deal. I'm going to say Marner especially, pardon me. I think the needle is going to move, and there are going to be some expensive bridge deals this summer. And that's something that sort of breaks the math but might be more reflective of the marketplace.
The NHL world waiting on these restricted free agents. One thing that has been stable, that's the goalie market. And Connor Hellebuck, had a fantastic campaign 2 years ago, got locked up to an extension, but came back down to earth last season. Could Laurent Brossard be employed next season in a tandem? Could Connor Hellebuyck get that 60-70 games again if he plays well? What's the goalie situation looking like in Winnipeg?
I think Connor Hellebuyck is still far and away the undisputed starter in Winnipeg, and you can expect at least 50 and probably at least 60 games from him, just because Winnipeg has leaned very heavily on their starter in the last couple of seasons. And even though Laurent Brossard played just spectacularly well to open the season last year, he did trail off towards the end, and even his career-long sample is still a little bit small from a mathematical point of view. If you're trying to predict how well these guys play, I think Hellebuck's still a better bet to be sort of an average, above-average NHL starter this year, and then Laurent Brossard sliding in just behind that. I would like to see a little bit more of a tandem, something like 50 to 32 in terms of those starts, to keep Hellebuck fresh and well into the playoffs should Winnipeg make it there. But we're at the point where there's a little bit of pressure on this team that sort of underachieved last season to eke out every last little bit of wins. If Laurent Brossoit comes out as hot as he did to open last season, you might see those numbers creep up. I don't think we're looking at a full tandem necessarily. And realistically, I think Hellebuck's going to bounce back this year. But I think that they're close enough in terms of a competition, and Winnipeg's desperate enough for those wins this season that you might see something a little bit more interesting, or Hellebuck starts to quad back a little bit.
You look at the stat sheet, which obviously doesn't tell the full story, but Brossoit had a really good season. Hellebuck struggled statistically. What exactly went wrong with Connor? And you said you think it could improve, but what are the odds that it does? Is it a sure thing or just a possibility?
I think it's something that I'm expecting, I guess. So with Hellebuck, goaltending in general has such a variance to it from a mathematical point of view that even when he signed, and, you know, we'll see how well it my take looks at in hindsight, but I wrote that his value was good at the contract that he got, but there might be 1 or 2 years of that long-term contract that he got where he wasn't an average NHL goaltender. And it's a little bit scary to think that it happened immediately, but with goaltenders being so impacted by luck and variance and bounces and everything like this, you'll see that happen with a lot of them from time to time. It happened to Carey Price. It can happen to Henrik Lundqvist. It can happen to even the very best that exists. So the question is, was this variance, was this something that you can just write off to math and numbers, or did Hellebuck actually take a step backwards? And it's my belief that he's healthy. It's my belief that his training is similar. I think that he is still in the prime of his career physically. And so what I'm expecting is that, you know, we might not be looking at another Vezina season from him immediately, but especially because of Winnipeg's defense being worse than what it's been for recent times. But I still believe that he's a good goaltender in the NHL and a good starter at that. And, well, I mean, what is the saying? Goaltending is voodoo. I think it's still healthier to bet on an average or above average season from him than, like, another step backwards.
The Manitoba Moose could also be possibly employing a tandem this season. They're coming off a short year. They missed the playoffs. What's the rundown in the AHL?
I think that the Moose are a unique opportunity for Winnipeg. So talking about that tandem, it could be Eric Comrie and Mikhail Berdin. I think that's the most likely situation. I rate Berdin very, very highly. And even though Eric Comrie has had a great season last year, and has taken steps forward in recent times, I think Berdin's the man with the higher ceiling, and meaningful starts for both players would be a really good thing for the pipeline. Winnipeg's also in a situation right now where they signed a few tweener-type players. So whether that's Yona Luoto or Andrei Chibisov, who I might see in the NHL, or the continued employment of Logan Shaw, Seth Griffith, the signing of Mark Letestu, there's a lot of veterans that should be primed to bolster that team just a little bit. I think the Moose are in good hands to continue to be a development thing or a developmental situation. A huge advantage with Winnipeg being a cap team and having the Moose in the same city and right down the hall is that you might find the team, Winnipeg that is, eking out $50,000 a week, $100,000 a week in extra cap space every now and again just by moving players back and forth when they have the luxury of doing that. They flirted with a 22-man roster at times last season, and I think you might see 21 at times this season as well, especially during their bye week. You might see it drop even more. And I think that that relationship between the Moose and the Jets is a strength for this organization and one that they recognize extremely well. Winnipeg might be cold, and you know, the taxes might not be as generous and kind to players as, say, in Nevada or something like that. But there are some organizational strengths just by being attached like that and shaped as they are in Winnipeg that I think the team really appreciates.
The Jets as a whole, they seem to be this budding dynasty 2 years ago, a team that was on the up and up and would do great things. And now there are these NHL analysts, there are people out there, they're the hot team as the team that's going to slump, miss the playoffs, and crash. What are your predictions of this team, especially in a crowded Central Division?
Yeah, I mean, the Winnipeg Jets taking a step back is not a risky proposition to put into the articles at this time, for sure. I mean, even from about January onward, they were a bottom 10 team in terms of all the 5-on-5 metrics, and they struggled down the stretch for a long period of time. So it would really, if you're calling a step back for them, just be a continuation of the second half of 2018-19. And I think that there's a certain amount of reasonability to that. it's not that I believe that last year's Jets were a bottom 10 team in terms of the quality of the roster. It's that I believe that there were things that they struggled with in terms of moving the puck up the ice and a little bit of stagnation through the neutral zone and in terms of some of the looks that they had. And, of course, injuries played a role, too. The problem is they need to overcome what was ailing them at the end of last season for the second half entirely without Jacob Trouba, without Tyler Myers, without Ben Sherratt, without Brandon Tanev. And of those that group of players, Jacob Trouba's impact is going to be felt by far and away the most. I guess you're going to see a lot of him out there as he plays for the Rangers. But I think that on paper, these Jets are a step back from last season already. And then with the central team getting as good as in adding players as they've mostly done, I mean, Minnesota is a funny situation right now. But by and large, the competition is getting stiffer at a time that Winnipeg's depth is being challenged. And I think, man, that's going to be a compelling storyline. I think it's completely fair to put them on the playoff bubble more than anything.
A compelling storyline indeed, mostly because, as you mentioned, the second half was not pretty, and this culture started to emerge where the Jets weren't that team of victory, that team that was winning almost every night from the year prior. And then the playoffs come around, the Jets run into the Blues. There were games they got heavily outshot. The series wasn't pretty, but they still put up a decent performance, I'd say. Did the Jets just run into a Blues team with some destiny, or were they truly outmatched in that series?
I would say yes to both of those questions, actually. It's a little footnote that I think is going to get lost in the analysis of last season for Winnipeg, is that the quality of hockey that they played in the first round against St. Louis was much higher than anything in the months that preceded it.
Mm-hmm.
That's me going by eye. I think it was about 18 minutes into the first period of game one where, just looking at their breakout, just looking at how they moved the puck up ice, how they were working the neutral zone, protecting their blue line, by eye, this team was playing the way that it had promised that it would finally get to for a really long time. And if you extend that into sort of the possession stats and, you know, shot attempts, expected goals, for the first five games, Winnipeg, again, played an excellent series in terms of possession against the league's hottest team and the eventual Stanley Cup champions. Game six, they fell off entirely, and St. Louis just put their foot on the throat. It was crazy in terms of the quality that St. Louis was able to find in that game. So I'm not saying that the Jets were of St. Louis's ilk in terms of quality, but they truly did raise their game, and having Morrissey and Byfuglien back, contributing, adding a fourth man to the neutral zone attack such that they could get to the offensive blue line kind of in a 4-on-3 oftentimes. There were a lot of nice things that Winnipeg did, but in the end, when push came to shove, they weren't there and didn't rise to the key moments. And to talk to them afterwards, when it was all said and done, I think that their struggles down the stretch actually kind of buried them. I think there was a little bit less belief and a little bit less will when things got difficult against St. Louis, and they seemed to accept their fate of that loss much, much more than they did the year prior against Vegas. And that was a bit stunning to me to listen to in the room. And I think it was well-deserved to not maybe have that confidence after those 4 months of sort of bottom tier that they played leading up to that series. So long-winded, but yes to both your suggestions, I think.
Interesting. And after that long season, after a rough season, the Jets stayed quiet in free agency. Obviously, it's expected. They're up against the cap. They don't really have much money to add. But do you agree with the decision to stay quiet? Maybe not go after that Jake Gardner, who's still out there and needs a contract, who apparently has some secret agreement with some team. There's players out there. Do you think the Jets add, or do you agree with this decision to do nothing in free agency?
You know, even as free agency was approaching, I was writing at The Athletic that it might be disappointing for Jets fans and it might be boring, but Winnipeg's best play would just be to let all of the unrestricted free agents that it had walk. I mean, the NHL system, the way that it is, with entry-level contracts being artificially cheap and restricted free agent contracts being artificially cheap and unrestricted free agent contracts being a bidding war with prices going sky high, and we saw that with Tyler Myers' deal in Vancouver and with Brandon Tanev's term and money that he got in Pittsburgh and all down the line, really. Winnipeg did well to walk from those players. Not that they're bad players, not that they can't help, but with the budget being what it is and value being bigger elsewhere on the roster, I think they made a really good decision to sort of sit tight, absorb the losses, and we might be looking at a developmental year, particularly on defense, where all of Pionk, Pullman, Beaulieu are a little bit untested. and will likely play important roles, Kulikov as well. Like, there are a lot of question marks on Winnipeg's back end, but given what they were approaching after the Trouba for Pionk trade and into free agency, I think it was the best play they could have made, and I don't necessarily see them adding yet. I think it's just about retaining Connor and Laine if all goes well for the team, and accepting that it could be difficult at times this year, but at least there's no dead money. At least there's no super long contract with a no-movement clause. It gives Kevin Sheveldayoff and the Winnipeg Jets a little bit of room to work with in an attempt to get back to that contender status.
For those of you just tuning in, you are listening to Destination Hockey. I am your host, David Lazar, with Jets reporter Murat Atesh. But you are not just any normal hockey reporter. Math meets storytelling is your motto. What exactly does that mean?
I like that question a lot, actually. I think it comes from a place where when I grew up watching hockey media, reading hockey media, consuming hockey media, just devouring it all, I got to a point where I realized that a lot of it was just about saying your opinion really loudly and assertively until people accepted it as true. And that began to bug me a little bit. I was like, well, sometimes it doesn't always add up. And we know things like some of the analytics coming into play that took a while to get traction in the league. And sometimes it's a little bit more complex than wanting it more and all that sort of stuff. So that was my path sort of into an analytics perspective. But the truth is, nobody cares what the numbers are if they don't add and supplement stories. We connect to sports because of stories. You know, you love the team that you love because you can trace their route to where they got today, and you can project them going forward because you know their story better than anyone else. And I think that it's important not to lose sight of why we love sports and that emotional connection. So even if I believe that, you know, if you're going to analyze it, you absolutely need to bring numbers and strategy into play, I think that it's really crucial to weave those two things together, and they're my biggest priorities as a writer, I think. So that's why it's in the Twitter bio. That's why it's in the bio at The Athletic. I just think that both are very, very important and that they should serve each other, and storytelling comes first, I guess.
It sounds like you just described my life. What made me so excited to have you on the show is that I'm actually double majoring in mathematics and sport journalism. No one understands it. I've had to defend my decision countless times, but let's hear from you. Why is this such a compatible match that I feel so passionate about and you clearly feel so passionate about?
First of all, I love it. I love that path. I wholeheartedly endorse it. Second of all, in terms of why do those things go together, I think that we attach to anything because of stories. We attach to sports because of stories. We process truth in the form of stories. What gets written in a compelling fashion is sort of what we take away from it. And if, like me, you kind of want the story that you're telling to be as close to true as you can get to, well, then you've got to sort of check yourself a little bit and like, okay, my memory isn't perfect. You know, maybe I thought Tyler Myers played great over this stretch of games, but maybe he was in his whole own end the entire time. So let's see what the numbers say about that. How much zone time did he have? What were his shot attempt numbers like, et cetera, et cetera. And then you can use math to inform your best version of truth and then use that and your ability to tell a story, which you're studying in journalism, to make it the most compelling version of that and really resonate the most with your audience. And to my mind, every individual journalist has their own reason for getting into journalism. And maybe you want to be around the big leagues. Maybe you want to be around the guys. Maybe you used to play hockey and it's the culture that you know and love best. For me, it is this vague attempt of telling what I believe to be the truth. And I think that's where numbers come from. But the numbers don't mean anything if you can't make them into compelling words, too. And that's really where my perspective comes from.
So how did you get to this point? Where did you go to school? What did you study? What extracurriculars did you do? How did the math make storytelling motto come to fruition?
It's long and it's winding. But I grew up as a math nerd. I at one point got recruited to a private school in Toronto because I had scored well on some national math contests. And it was always kind of this language that made sense to me and this interest that I had for sure. But by the time I got into university, I was more interested in people. I studied psychology for a little while. I studied environmental science and policy and communications for a little while. And I found in those lives that the ability to communicate was more important than having the exact objective truth in terms of what math seemed to me or what I idealized math to be at that time. And I worked in travel writing. I would travel and these crazy things would happen, and I would write stories about things like that. And I worked for international centers at the university and all these sorts of things. And this sounds maybe random and like these things don't necessarily all fit together, but every single one of those contributed in some way to my ability, I think, to tell a story and to connect with readers and to understand that the difference between what numbers might say to me and what numbers might say to somebody else and the importance of communicating extremely well, that comes from all sorts of those different paths. So I really feel awkward about this answer because it's not a prescription, hey, do these things and you'll be well prepared. But I do think that there were truths and lessons learned in every single one of those fields that sort of contributed to what my perspective is and what I still want to grow into and keep getting better at.
But that is the blueprint. It's the artistic way of saying just staying versatile, doing as much as you can, staying active in as many talents as you have. That's the way to do it. And I completely agree and admire you for doing it. You've been versatile thus far in your life. Before we let you go, what are your goals for the future? How are you going to grow off the career you've had so far with math and storytelling? How can you grow this path that you've made?
For sure. Step one, I think, for me, comes from an experience that I had at the draft where all the athletic NHL writers got together, and there were 65 of us in a room. And, I mean, some people were unable to make it for family commitments or other, but there were 65 of us in a room, and I was able to see how other people killed it in different facets of journalism. So some people are just brilliant at breaking news and building those relationships, and that's an area that I have to grow in. And, you know, I feel strong about analytics, and that's an area that I will always have to stay fresh in. And there's different strengths and weaknesses, and I think that being honest with myself about where to keep pushing and where to add and who to look up to for those sorts of things is the immediate term goal. And my perspective about writing for The Athletic and covering the Winnipeg Jets is the same as in life as well, is to do the thing as wholeheartedly as you possibly can, and you'll learn the lessons that you need to learn. And ideally that the more wholeheartedly that I can throw myself into this, and I truly, truly do, I believe that, you know, whatever my weaknesses are, I can learn. And, I mean, that's a bit cheesy, but I think it's how I got here and the lesson that I know. And it's what you just said, too, right? Be multifaceted, do lots of different things. And I think it serves a person well. So that's, for better or for worse, whether it's true or false, that's sort of just doing it wholeheartedly is my goal. And then whatever comes of it in terms of tangibles, well, we'll see.
That was the one and only Murat Ateş. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you so much for having me today.
Of course. When we return, Rob Schremp will be live to discuss his time on the New York Islanders, his NHL career, and yes, of course, John Tavares. From the destination for all things hockey, we will be right back.
Did you know that 1 in 5 people are affected by mental illness? NAMI Hunterdon is the locally affiliate for NAMI, the National Alliance on Mental Illness. We are all volunteers, and all our programs are free of charge. We offer Family to Family, a 12-week course for families that have an adult member with a mental illness. Another popular program is In Our Own Voice, where individuals who are living with mental illness discuss their challenges and their progress in overcoming those challenges. Another course we offer is Basics, a 6-week course for families with a child or an adolescent who has experienced mental illness. We also have a monthly support group for families on the third Thursday of every month. Please call NAMI Hunterdon at 908-284-0500 for more information about any of our programs or to join. NAMI Hunterdon, the voice for mental health in Hunterdon County.
You're listening to WHCR-DB, HunterdonChamberRadio.com, brought to you by the Hunterdon County Chamber of Commerce, the voice of business.
Hello, this is Nicole Smith, host of Happy to Help. Would you like to discover the secret to happiness? I talk to volunteers, executive directors, fundraisers, and authors about how nonprofit engagement enriches their lives. We thrive when we have a sense of purpose in our lives. Philanthropy is the new community. Tune in to Happy to Help every Wednesday at 10 a.m. to discover how to find your purpose and live well by doing good.
Did you know? The Hunterdon County Chamber of Commerce has over 20 active committees that you can participate in. Committees range from focus on business and government to economic development to events like our annual business expo. Contact the Chamber for more information today at 908-782-7115 or email us at info@hunterdon-chamber.org. The Hunterdon County Chamber of Commerce, the voice of business.
Welcome to Destination Hockey. There are players growing up that you idolize just because they are good people and fun to watch. For me, that was Rob Schremp, and we have him live on Destination Hockey today. Thank you so much for joining me.
Thanks for having me.
Appreciate it. So you were a shootout legend, one of the best to lace up the skates with your fancy stick tricks, silky mitts, and dangles. How did you perfect your craft?
I spent a lot of time on the ice as a kid. At the same time, I played multiple sports, so I felt like lacrosse was one thing that really correlated over to hockey for me with the kind of the tricks and the stuff with the puck and, rolling the wrist in lacrosse kind of is the same as stick handle with a hockey stick. It's just kind of in the air. So that was really just having fun with other sports, and I tried it out in hockey, and it kind of took off a little bit, I guess, so to speak.
With shootouts being discussed more and more on the NHL stage, do you think there is still a place for them in the modern game?
I think they're exciting. That being said, the 3-on-3 method has been pretty cool as well. I'm a fan of that. It's exciting. The whole concept is kind of to create entertainment, and that's that's what sells tickets, and that's what gets people in the stands. So whatever that takes. And I found the shootout to be very exciting, and never really had that much experience of it before the NHL. To be honest with you, in junior, we didn't have it yet, and didn't do that many of them. So it was fun. One-on-one with the goalie, it's a pretty cool, unique atmosphere for both the player and the fan. But then, that being said, there's sometimes where you're like, oh, I wish that wasn't ended by a shootout. So there's an argument both ways, but I think whatever creates the most entertainment and keeps the fans happy, that's fun.
Coming from a shootout icon himself, who do you think is the best shootout specialist in the NHL today?
That's a good question. Patty Kane is unreal. He's sick. He really has the whole concept down of the breakaway / shootout and how to manipulate the goalie and almost make him look foolish. Franz Nielsen was one of the best as well.
Oh, yeah.
So I got a chance to play with him and watch. He had two kind of go-to moves that he went to and had him down pat. So he was a really high percentage shooter. Those two guys are, I'd say Patty Kane is my pick for right now for the best shootout guy.
Love that.
Fun to watch.
Oh, yeah. Love that Franz Nielsen backhand. Patrick Kane, amazing as well. But back to you, a noticeable aspect of your career, you were on the last Atlanta Thrashers team. What was it like playing with that storyline always looming over your head?
To be honest with you, I didn't know they were on their way out. I didn't find out, and I had no idea. I got picked up off waivers from the
Islanders
them, and I think it was like February, and never really knew the background story of what was going on there. And then I got a text from Andrew Ladd. I think it would have been April or May, saying, hey, guys, the team's relocating. So it was kind of a bit of a surprise to me, to be honest with you. But that being said, being on the last team there was definitely something unique. And I still have my Thrashers bag, and I carry it around for my men's league game. So something pretty cool.
You really gave hockey a great go. You learned so many lessons from it, as you've been vocal about. But now, a new life ahead. How nice is it to be focused on other things, playing hockey for fun, and just to take that breath of exhale?
Absolutely. It's great to be a family man and spend time being a dad and watch my daughter grow up and being focused on other things like you mentioned. It was a fun time. It was a fun ride. But that being said, it was time to be over. So my mind has been focused towards other things and learning how to be, kind of a businessman per se and also many other things besides a hockey player, not just a hockey player. I don't want to be just a hockey player my whole life. So it's fun to try to do different things outside of the game and have success at it and work hard at it and find results.
One of the things I admire, you have been vocal about mental health, a problem that affects so many people today, and you're now working as an athletic liaison with AG Health. How has your life post-hockey, specifically becoming more vocal, helped you grow personally?
It's been a big relief for me personally, and to be able to speak about it, talk about it, help other people with it, and mentioning my story and having the people kind of the outpour come back and say thank you for sharing. I have the same issues, or this is what I go through. And being a helping ear or helping hand for somebody else is gratifying. It's definitely something I'm proud to be part of. I didn't think I'd ever really want to open up about that kind of stuff, but having done it and seeing the results of it is gratifying for sure. And anytime you can help other people, I think it's important to do so in whatever manner that might be.
The CBD industry, one that you are now a leader in, it's misrepresented, has a lot of false narratives that many people believe. What's the future of your industry that's helping so many people?
The future really is, it's getting people back to balance in their body. Everybody has an endocannabinoid system in their body, so it hasn't been fed or used for a long time since hemp has been out of our system. Not just, the big kind of misconception that CBD is weed. It's not weed. There's two different, totally different strands. And there's very low levels of THC in the CBD brands. And then the isolated one, there's no THC. So it still has effects, positive effects, and it's not, so to speak, getting high. It's just helping your body balance out, whether it's inflammation. For me, I had really bad anxiety issues, and it helped me just not go into those bad tailspins of anxiety attacks. So I think it's huge to help with, taking certain medicines that, you could wind up taking for a long time. You wind up having effects on your other organs in your body. They say it helps with sleep. That helps. Also, people, there's a lot of issues with taking sleeping pills for a long time. There's no real, I don't know what the research on that is, but it's not a positive thing to be taking Ambien for 30 years. So these kind of things have been benefits from CBD, and it's been helping a lot of people from, my experience, and then hearing the feedback from other people, trying the product. So that's gratifying to see and help in that manner and be an advocate, so to speak, on the matter.
How does it relate to opioids, and why is that so important?
Well, it has pain relief abilities. It has anti-inflammatory abilities. It has anxiety relief abilities, all these things. So when you're cutting down on the opioids, I think it's important because those long-term effects are huge. They break down your body. And, having a little bit of experience myself and the experience of my family, it alters you. It's a tough medicine. And also a lot of people, I think it's pretty obvious in the country that, it leads to other addictions. So if you can help that path not go that way and change it and help it go down a more positive, more beneficial, more natural path, I think that's important. And that's really what it is. And it's not a full-on attack against opioids. It's just if you can find something else that's sustainable and it's better, more beneficial for your body, then I think anybody would take a look at that and give it a try. Sometimes people still need to take opioids, but it's just a matter of you see the epidemic of addiction and heroin addiction, and a lot of the heroin addiction starts from opioid addiction. So it's something that I think everybody's kind of focusing on in this country and other places in the world where we can, how do you stop it? How do you help it? And we're just one piece of that puzzle.
Something the NHL world was focusing on last year, that was Robin Leonard. He took the world by storm, opening up about his mental illness and putting forth a dominant season. What did it mean to you to see that special narrative unfold, seeing someone be so open, especially for your New York Islanders?
Absolutely. I think I was very proud of him, and it's inspirational to have him speak so openly and honestly about it. So, and to see that you can perform, you can still play. I think a lot of guys have gotten buried or kind of cut from the game because of it, but I think there's some instances like Robin's where you can help a person, and not just about a hockey player, but as a human being, and that wind up panning out, and he wind up having an unbelievable season. So I think it's important. I think it's a point where I think we're learning that you can be open. You should be able to be open about those things and say, hey, listen, I'm having these problems or these thoughts, and saying that shouldn't lead to you being exiled. It's not fair, and I don't think it's right. So his words are very right on the money, and I think it's important for people to be able to be open about it. I mean, this is something not all of us choose to have. I don't think people choose to have these issues. So when you have them, you want some support and some guidance, not if I say something, I'm going to get exiled. So I think it's really going to knock down a lot of barriers and help a lot of people. Like I said, if you can help people in any way, I think it's important to do so, and he's doing a great job at that.
Robin Leonard, one of the first New York Islanders to lace up the skates back at Nassau Coliseum. You played there. It's one of the best arenas in the NHL in terms of atmosphere. How great was it to play in that arena, and how do you think it helped the New York Islanders specifically this season?
Yeah, I think going back to the roots was huge. and having that, you know, ingrained fan support back in the organization, and having those, you know, I think the fans were really happy to have the games back there and having close to where it's, you know, quote unquote supposed to be almost. But it was a cool atmosphere. It was a great place to go in and play, and having some of the legends be around the rink when I played there was something so cool. Having a dynasty like they did is something special, and it's hard to come by. It hasn't happened that often. So it's really unique to go down there and lace up your skates in a place where you know that something special happened.
Barry Trotz came on board this year. Barry Trotz, a respected member in the NHL world. How did he specifically help the Islanders creating this feeling of team over individual that you've highlighted in the past?
Yeah, I think it was huge. They played as a unit, and they were kind of a pain in the ass to play against, and you can see that in the results. And they played as a unit, and I wasn't in the room, but just watching the games, I mean, they really bonded together. And they had, you get to see the guys, and you can see the way after a goal or after a big play or something like that, the way the team responded was unique. And there's something to say about Barry and the way he manages his bench. He won a Stanley Cup with the Capitals, and there's been a few coaches that took a whack at it and didn't get it done there. He got it done, and then he comes over to the Islanders and has that success. So he's a well liked man in the hockey world. He had one of the longest tenure jobs in Nashville. People have nothing but great things to say about him. So. He obviously knows the way to speak to his players and how to treat them, and I think with the story with Leonard and how that worked out, it's important the guy that was behind the bench was supportive as well, and that speaks volumes for him as a person and not just a hockey coach.
A man who is not as well-liked, that is John Tavares, and you were vocal about his time on the team, offering your opinion on Twitter, saying he just collects his points and his awards. What are your thoughts on the ex-Islanders captain?
Yeah, you know, he's off doing his thing in Toronto, right back where he dreamed of playing. So, good for him. And you know, I spoke my words and kind of backed away from it a little bit, made a little bit more noise than I would have liked to. But you know, I spoke my piece, and it is what it is. But I didn't understand and I didn't know the depth of the stuff that was going on Long Island with the contract stuff. I didn't have any idea what was going on there, the depth of it. I literally was sitting on my porch in Florida, saw the tweet, and I wrote what I thought. It got some attention.
Oh yeah,
it's like whoops. But you know, I don't know. I think some fans explain it. You know, he said he was going to stay, he didn't stay. It's up to him. And the way he treated the situation, the fans have every right. They supported. They bought jerseys, and you know, they came, showed up to the game, so they have every right to have an opinion on the piece. So I don't, for that matter. I don't really care what Johnny did or what he's doing. Yeah, that's how I feel about it.
One thing that you can't deny, though, is John Tavares on February 28th got a reaction that has never happened in professional sports history. It seemed like the Roman Coliseum. How did you feel about that game, the reaction he received? Do you think it was cool, or do you think it was a little too much on February 28th?
Well, like I just touched on it, those fans paid good hard money and supported him and his team. And you know, that's their almost their right, how they go about it. I mean, who's going to tell them not to? They pay the money to go. The organization can't tell police stop. They spend the money on season tickets, and they were genuinely hurt and kind of crushed by what the situation was with the contract and leaving. So for them to show up and show their dislike is totally on them, how they want to handle it. So but that being said, I don't wish that on Johnny either. I mean, I'm an athlete, was a professional athlete. Like that, it had to be really tough on him. Kind of a quiet guy, an introvert, and having that kind of attention, I'm sure he was not feeling that great about it. So I feel bad for him, but that being said, when you make decisions, sometimes there's backlashes.
Your time on the Islanders, you've said it was one of the best times in your career. The Islanders fan base really embraced you. They really liked you, and it was a good run with the New York Islanders. How great was that time in your career?
Yeah, I really enjoyed it. You know, it's the first time I really got a chance to get in the lineup and play. Not time in Edmonton wasn't that great. I only played 7 games over a few years. So it was the first time I got to be a regular and play and be in the room and feel comfortable and kind of breathe a little bit knowing I'm going to be in the lineup. And it was amazing. I'm always grateful for that opportunity to play and get a chance to do some cool shootouts and play, you know, with some great players. So it was awesome. I really enjoyed my time at Long Island. The room, the locker room, playing with Dougie Wade, guys like this, was Ricky D was there. I mean, these guys were cool guys to play with, and get to strap it up every day and go and skate with them was definitely unique and something I'll cherish.
Your career was an adventure, OHL legend, Islanders fan favorite, European star, and now an ambassador for an important cause. How fun is the ride?
It's been great. I learned a lot. You know, I've learned a lot of stuff and been in a lot of places in the world, so I got to meet a lot of great people and be to live in different cultures and different cities and different teams, meet a bunch of people. So the path has been great, and now the fact that I get to jump on with a company that has a great mission in sight is something I'm proud of and I'm excited about, and it gives me a little bit more comfort dropping the stick and walking away and having the different goals in mind and different views. So I'm really excited, and I'm proud of what I accomplished in the hockey world, and now it's time to go off in the real world and see what I can do.
A great conversation with Islanders fan favorite Rob Schremp. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
Of course. One of my favorite interviews to do right there. An idol to look up to as a kid with those dangles, with the lacrosse style moves, and finally get to speak with him. That was really cool. What else is really cool? We've got some jam-packed episodes coming up over the next few weeks. Some more players coming on the show. We're going to continue that theme with Rob Schremp with two great interviews with two star defensemen that you're going to want to hear. That concludes another episode of Destination Hockey. You can catch us at Instagram at @drive4five, Twitter at @drive45_, and on Facebook at the official Destination Hockey page. SeatGeek is a great website that you can use to buy tickets. The Yankees are hot. The Mets are hotter. If you want $5 baseball tickets, use our special code DRIVE45 on SeatGeek. From the destination for all things hockey, really excited to announce two big interviews coming up. As I just mentioned, guys, it's going to be a great rest of the summer. So we'll see you next week.
What do you want to do when you grow up? When we were young, it's a question we were often asked. As we get older, our passions become clearer, our pursuits become careers, and if we're diligent, we begin to plan for the life we want to live. That's why, at Ameriprise Financial, we ask what's most important to you. Starting with our confident retirement approach, your Ameriprise Financial advisor will ask questions that help you arrive at a customized plan that allows you to realize your goals today, tomorrow, and throughout retirement. With the right financial advisor, life can be brilliant. Call Michelle Heide and Associates, a private wealth advisory practice of Ameriprise Financial Services Incorporated, today at 908-713-6600. Office is located at 16 Lee Street, Units 1B and 1C in Clinton, New Jersey. The confident retirement approach is not a guarantee of future financial results. Investment advisory products and services are made available through Ameriprise Financial Services Incorporated, a registered investment advisor.
To close at 78.33. The S&P gained 37 to close at 28.82. This is USA Radio News.
It is a horrible scenario, but it happens. Dennis writes about his wife. She was diagnosed with leukemia. In fact, she's a two-time survivor, and in the midst of all that, they ran up over $1 million in medical bills. Thankfully, they're Medishare members, and Dennis says they are so thankful for that, how others came together to meet their needs, and that's how so many Medishare members feel. This is not health insurance. It's different. You don't have to pay for things you don't believe in. And like Dennis found out, it just works. So if you join Medishare, not only do you save a lot of money, a typical family saves about $500 a month, but you know where your money's going each month. You're helping people, and if the time should come, they'll be helping and even praying for you. So yes, it's different, and as more than 400,000 people now know, when it comes to healthcare costs, different is beautiful. Find out more. Call 833-34-BIBLE. That's 833-34-BIBLE. 833-34-BIBLE.
A key U.S. senator weighs in on the president's strategy in Afghanistan. USA Radio Network's Chris Barnes reports from Washington.
Reports are the Trump administration's getting ready to withdraw thousands of U.S. troops from Afghanistan as it's reached an initial deal with the Taliban. Republican South Carolina Senator Lindsey Graham says he's hoping the administration won't go too far with this move.
Every commander I've talked to, the intelligence community says that Al-Qaeda and ISIS are reemerging in Afghanistan, that if we withdraw all of our forces, they can hit us in the region and here at home. This is exactly what they told President Obama. It is not right to leave.
Graham was speaking on Fox News. And for USA Radio News, I'm Chris Barnes.
U.S. Ambassador John Huntsman is leaving his post in Russia. Huntsman has submitted his resignation and will leave Moscow in early October.